beyond civilization, do you talk about your next tribal enterprise as a learning circus?
Ah.
Has that...
I talked about it as an enterprise I would like to see come to pass, but I am not an organizer of any kind, and it wasn't something that I was going to personally spearhead to pursue, but I didn't get any nibbles from any direction, so nothing happened to it. Still a good idea. Mm-hmm. Yes?
How would you personally compare and contrast the pros and cons of homeschooling versus the unschooling free school movement?
Well, that's an interesting question. As I made clear in my Israel, I'm not a fan of schooling of any kind, that is, of marching children together according to a preset plan all together at the same time, regardless of what their personal interests might be. Homeschooling and unschooling can often be the same thing.
So like the Albany Free School, for instance, like organizations like that are trying to be progressive?
Yes.
Are you familiar with
that? I'm not familiar with that particular one.
It was something close to what you had said about like kind of a place for people to go and pursue their own educations on their own terms versus doing that through the home.
I don't know that particular program. Any building that separates children from the community for the purpose of their pursuing education is going to be an artificial environment. And of course, there are better schools and worse schools. Of course, in Houston, a teacher who had been inspired by what I said in my Ishmael. She was at a magnet school and had a rather small population of local children as well, who had not been drawn there by the magnet. They simply lived in the neighborhood, and they were generally they're kind of fringe students and in danger of dropping out. And so she thought she was given the opportunity to create a program for them, and so she decided to see if it was possible to pursue a program based on the ideas I proposed in Ishmael. And she called it Continuum 10. She got in touch with me via email, not knowing that we lived blocks from each other, as it happened. And so we got together and began working on this together. And this program, she did a marvelous job of organizing this program, contacting businesses all over the city, arranging for all of the kids in the program to have bus passes, and allowing the children to select where they would like to go to hang out with people involved in all sorts of different businesses and activities. And they all went on their own. This was a middle school program. And by the end of the year, they had this group of children had advanced amazingly, so much that when I met with their parents at a bookstore to discuss the program and what had happened, they were just overwhelmed and amazed at the progress their children had made in independent living and in being responsible for themselves. But as I predicted, the fact that it was successful aroused tremendous envy and hatred in the school among other teachers and the administration, and it received a lot of publicity as well, and so they saw to it that it was not repeated. What made it interesting was it was an attempt to open up the city to the children, as opposed to imprisoning them in a building and perhaps bringing people in. So I think there's no reason why other schools couldn't do the same. I think that was very idealistic and very successful application of these ideas. But I endorse both homeschooling and unschooling. So long answer, I'm not sure it's an answer that addresses your question. The best I can do. Yes. Yes.
Here. Yes. I believe I'm aware that you have said somewhere that you don't want to be anyone's guru, and I have my own opinions about what I'm about to ask. I'm wondering, there's a number of elements of the paranormal in your books, like telepathy, reincarnation, yes. And I'm thinking of a few others. I know other people can think of them.
That's going to work. Yes.
So there's a number of elements of the paranormal in your books, and I'm wondering, I guess I haven't understood this to be answered in any of your books or materials, and I've read many of them, but why are we here? And do you believe in a consciousness or a life after death? I know you wrote a book on that, but I still don't really understand what you think about those things.
Well, the fact is that I don't have anything that corresponds to what people think of as beliefs. I would be very glad if there were an afterlife, if we did survive this life in some form. But I can't say that I believe that we do. I can't say that I believe that we don't. There's certainly what this a lot of stuff that some people would consider evidence, but I'm not sure that I consider it evidence. I like to think that we live in a universe that is informed by the divine, but I don't believe in God. I don't believe that there is no God, but I do prefer to think that there are gods, but I won't argue with anyone about it. I like to think that we live in a universe that is occupied by other intelligent species, but I don't believe that we are, I don't believe that we're not. So it's a little hard to describe where I stand on these things. That's not really a good answer to your question. How close did I come?
It's honest. I appreciate that.
Honest. I always try to do that anyway.
Yeah, articulate in your way, but I'm just wondering, there's so many elements of the paranormal, and it's just, I'm wondering why that is.
In my books.
Yeah, telepathy, reincarnation.
Well, those are
animist experiences.
Yes. I am an animist, but I don't, there is no evidence for telepathy. There is no evidence for reincarnation. Although many people in the East do believe it without question. In my fiction, I use them as fictional elements, not to assert their reality, but to use them as a basis for a fiction. Yes. I was not brought up in a religious family, no. I was a Roman Catholic for how many years? I don't know, a couple decades. But that did not affect my writing at all. I was, when I began to work on the book that eventually became Ishmael, I was close to being an atheist, but as I became more acquainted with the people that I call believers and saw their own religious convictions and practices and statements and mythologies, I began to formulate my description of animism as the common element of all of these peoples. If you approach any one of them and ask them what an animist is, they would look at you blankly, because the term animism was coined by one of us, not one of them, back at near the end of the 19th century, basically describing it as the belief that everything has a spirit in it. That's the way it was defined at the time, which is hardly a fair description of it at all. This was based mostly on missionary reports who tended to see Aboriginal peoples as ignorant and childlike and simple-minded and superstitious. And so it's not surprising that they described animism as a combination of ignorance, childlike thinking, and superstition. But as I looked at them and studied them, what I came to see was that they viewed the earth as a sacred place and viewed humans as belonging in a sacred place. This is in contrast to the Christian view, which sees the earth as a mere stopping place, a place where we are tested to see whether we're worthy of heaven or not. And having no intrinsic value itself, we are the ones who have value in the Christian view. But even so, if the world were a sacred place, we would not really belong in it, because we are not sacred ourselves. We are a fallen race in need of salvation. So this is the difference between the Christian view and the animistic view. Being an animist doesn't mean that I perform particular rituals or anything like this. This is simply the way I see the world. It's less a religion than a world view. Yes?
I came because I wanted to say that I appreciated just that very quality that I read Ishmael about the statement that indigenous community people had two choices, which was either genocide or enter the cultural prison. And I'm 1 year away from 60, and I have never heard quote, non-Indigenous or non-Native person have a perspective from that worldview to articulate so clearly. You gave some background about this defining what animism is. How did you formulate and come to that to that fact? Because there is such a denial in this country of that very fact, and yet you have other part of the answer in the book that says that the takers do not even have the key for their end of destruction.
Yes, the reaction among Native peoples in America was astonishment that a white man could possibly say the things I said in Ishmael, could articulate these things, and they themselves, so many people, when they write to me, they thank me for articulating things that were in their minds in some fashion or other. And this is, I don't think that any Native American could have written this book, even though everything I said in it was perfectly obvious to them. How I came to it, I began reading in this area back in the early 1960s without any particular thought of ever writing a book. That didn't cross my mind. I was simply looking for answers myself. I was trying to understand how it could possibly be that the first 3 million years of human life could be without value, without meaning, which is what it appeared to be among in history as taught in our schools. Those millions of years are worth talking about. There's nothing there. No philosopher has ever looked at those 3 million years to ask the question, I wonder what that was all about. And I wondered, what is it all about? I wondered why no one was interested. And so I was reading to that point, always pursuing that question, is what was it all about? Were these people living meaningless lives? I couldn't believe that at all. So what was the meaning of their lives? That was what I was pursuing. And so I read for 20 years seeking that answer, but I can't exactly point out how when I arrived at the exact point that you see in Ishmael. You might look at the book called Providence that I wrote, sort of an autobiography that was written in answer to the many people who wrote to me to ask where this book had come from. Providence is, that would be the closest that I could give you. I'm not sure that even that would answer the question for you. I wish I could answer the question. The other remaining question that everyone has asked, the only one that I have not figured out how to answer, is where did all these strange ideas come from? How did you come to be this alien thinker? And how can I do it? I did start a book called Conversation with a Martian. I still may finish it. I would like to finish it, but I'm sort of stumped at the moment. Looking in the corners.
Yes. If any of you, as you muse about in the next 20, 30 years, a neo-tribal economic revolution occurs, much like the Industrial Revolution, how would that affect or facilitate the world human population being brought back to a sustainable number? Or would it affect it at all?
I don't know that it would affect it at all. That was not my idea in writing about this in My Ishmael and in Beyond Civilization, but rather the idea that so much of our effort that is directed toward the consumption of the world is the result of our fundamental unhappiness and feeling of frustration and insecurity. Because we lack things, well, I turn around and say this, that we look at Aboriginal peoples and think that they are poor. And if they were to be able to look at us, leave their culture and look at us, they would think us poor, rich in toys, but poor in spirit. Really a deadly impoverishment. Tribal life is a life of complete security from cradle to grave. This doesn't sound like so much, but none of us have it. No one in this room has it. I don't even think Bill Gates has it. And it is my theory that if people were getting more of what humans need, then they would be less anxious to have a bigger car, to have a more powerful computer, to have more channels of sports, and would begin perhaps to think differently about the world and create a different climate, which would perhaps eventually result in some change regarding issues like population. What I found, for example, in the East Mount News, that we had a group of people who were having a wonderful time, all of us living below this poverty level, but having a very fulfilling time, and doing things that we really like to do, and it was a great way to live. Unfortunately, it eventually couldn't go on, but I had a wonderful tribal sort of relationship with my last publisher who unfortunately went bankrupt just before we could bring out Tales of Adam, in which he was pretty marginal as a publisher, was a very small publisher, without a lot of cash resources, and anything that I could do to help him with his make his living as a publisher, he knew he could call upon me to do, having nothing to do with my books, and I knew that I could call upon him to do anything for me that I needed, and so it was a terrible blow when. Eventually, when the recession first hit, and of course it hits publishers very quickly because people can live pretty well without books, and then 9/11 destroyed his fall season of books. Nobody was buying books at all, and so he was forced into bankruptcy. So it was a great loss to me. Personally, and of course, it lost to him as well. Again, I know this is not an adequate answer to the question. That's probably the case with most of the questions I get asked.
I have a question.
Okay.
There are quite a few topics that you could cover when talking about Ishmael in the various books. And we've spent a good deal of time talking about tribalism, and I know you speak quite a bit about tribalism. And I was curious about sustainability, and specifically I was curious about any opportunities you may have had in your life, and if you might share anything you've come across in terms of sustainability and what you've done and how you might have achieved certain goals to that effect.
Well, it's interesting to note that at the time I was writing Ishmael, the word sustainability, I'm not even sure that it was in general use, so you won't find it in Ishmael. It would have been very handy for me to do it. It would save me a lot of talking around. Uh, I myself don't have an extraordinary life in any way. I don't do anything that all of you don't do. Question that's often asked me is whether I, if they ask it one way or another, whether I practice what I preach. And I say, well, what do I preach? And of course, what Ishmael tells his student near the end of the book is teach 100 people what you've learned here and urge them to teach 100. And pretty challenging. So I feel like I practice what I preach because I reach about 100,000 people a year, so I'm doing the work of 1,000. But I'm no paragon of simple living, for example. I live a very ordinary kind of life.
Have you... I didn't mean for it to be specifically attacking your...
Oh, no, I didn't feel it was been attacked, believe me.
Have you had an opportunity to see perhaps people who have contacted you and talked about some of the things that they've done? Or?
Well, the most amazing example of that is Ray Anderson, who's the founder and CEO of the Interface Corporation, the largest manufacturer of commercial carpeting in the world. He had always, from the beginning of his company, been very assiduous in, scrupulous in following government regulations of his industry. But when he read two books, The Ecology of Commerce, Paul Huffman's book, and Ishmael, he saw that merely following regulations was not nearly enough. The commercial carpeting in general at the time was entirely petroleum, all plastic, even though it felt pretty good. He made up his mind that his company would immediately begin to work on producing carpeting that was entirely petroleum free. Beyond that, it would be carpeting that was made entirely from recycled materials and that was in itself 100% recyclable, and that he would urge his customers to not throw away carpeting when they were finished, but that he would come in and take their carpeting and give them new carpeting and recycle their old carpeting so as to close that circle. Because he was the leader of the field, his competitors were compelled to follow his lead. And so he changed the whole industry because of two books. Beyond, even further than that, he compelled giants like DuPont to come up with solutions that he needed. So they began to look at sustainability issues as well. This is how it happens, how I see it happening, and why Ishmael's message is change 100 minds. This is how it happens, is that cheap people's minds get changed, and then remarkable things happen. I could not have remotely, if Ray Anderson had come to me and said, well, Daniel, what should I do? I'm the head of this giant carpet manufacturing company. I said, well, I have not the slightest idea what you should do. Because he had to change mind, he knew what he had to do.
It's interesting that you talked about Mr. Anderson, because I saw the movie The Corporation, and he talks about that. It sounded like when I saw the movie that he might have been influenced by your book. I remember thinking that at the time. But it seems to me like, you know, your book lays out this great philosophy. Do you ever see Guns, Germs, and Steel seems to kind of put some facts behind a lot of what you think. I was wondering if you know if that was a book that was maybe influenced by your philosophy.
I really don't know whether the author was Terradon.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he's really ever seen my stuff. Mind you. But certainly it's been tremendous to see, starting in the 1990s, to see so many mind-changing books appearing, and that's a very encouraging sign for the future.
Yes. I just wanted to comment to you to talk about this Carpenter Fellow. I'm here tonight because of the professional award by some management professors at MIT.
Yeah, it's been an amazing experience. I had no idea that Ishmael would ever be used, or any of my books would ever be used in the classroom. I was stunned when it finally was. And I mean, heard so many tales, I realized that when teachers discover the book, it doesn't matter what they teach, they find a way to use it in the classroom. Just the other night, a chemistry teacher who used it in the intro class. It's been used in the police ethics class. It's been used in the history of opera class.
Yes, I read a book written by a Graham called Fingerprints of the Bones. And he used an expression that I had never heard before, and it was, he thought that we were all under the influence of a powerful global amnesia. Mm. And it was as if everybody accepted the idea that history began really around the time of the Egyptians, and there really wasn't an awful lot done before that.
Yeah, and
it's just like dismissing this whole body of time. And you mentioned that earlier, and I wanted to comment and tell you that I really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because, of course, in the story of B, that's called the Great Forgetting. So I don't know whether he picked up the idea from me and gave it a different name, Global Amnesia. But it's very good. It could be just two people coming across the same realization, of course. Wow.
I got a question over here.
Okay.
You like, from your reading earlier, you seem to point out, like, a problem. Like, Cain had a problem. Like, it was kind of like he was going for too much. Like, kind of like, what is our problem? Like, and is it fixable, or, like, is sustainability possible, or are we just headed for disaster?
Or are we what?
Headed for disaster.
if we go on the way we are, I'm afraid, yes, we are headed for disaster. There's no doubt about that.
Is the dream possible? Do you believe, like, I guess that's kind of my question. Like, can we fix what we've done? Or is, like...
Well, I wrote a speech delivered a few years ago called The New Renaissance, and that's available on my website. And what I said in that was that in the historical Renaissance, which you learn in school about what happened in the 14th century on, and the 14th, 15th, 16th century, was truly a revolution of the mind. All sorts of very fundamental ideas of the Middle Ages were challenged and dismissed and replaced. one idea that survived from the Middle Ages through the Renaissance and through the Enlightenment to the present time is the idea that humans belong to an order of being that is separate from the rest of the living community on this planet. This is a very dangerous idea. And if there are still people living here in 200 years, they will know that we do not belong to a separate order of being from the rest of the living community. Because if people go on thinking that, there will not be people living here in 200 years. Because if people go on thinking that, they will go on living the way we do. And if people go on living the way we do, there will not be people here in 200 years. But if there is a new Renaissance, and there is a global mind change, a tipping point, I'm thankful to the author of that book for that very helpful insight, then I think it is possible. And I think we are reaching for that tipping point, and it's impossible to say how far away it is. 20 years ago, nobody in the world outside of the Soviet Union could have predicted that the Soviet Union would ever dissolve. It was iron, made out of iron. But because within Russia, there were a growing number of people who were dissatisfied with it, in a very short period of time, that number became minority to being a slight majority, and that's all it took. It wasn't an overwhelming majority. It was a big enough majority to enable Gorbachev to begin to disassemble the Soviet Union and end the Cold War. So I'm confident that that can happen. I can't say it will happen in the next 10 years or the next 20 years, but I hope it will come in 10 years. It could happen. And nothing is faster than changing people's minds. We're not going to people course from the beginning. We're saying, yes, but what are we supposed to do? And I think what they were thinking is, you know, should we write to our congressman? And the fact is that we're not going to get any help from our leaders until we begin to put leaders in who are different. We need a new electorate before we're going to get new leaders. And otherwise we're going to keep putting in people like George Bush. So changing minds, I continue to insist, is the thing to do. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just thought I wanted to mention, you're talking about current leaders, the success of defeating the drilling in Anwar in the budget. And I just wanted to mention that as something that lifted my heart. I did not think that would be protected as well.
Yes.
Oh, I'm just wondering, as a Russian person, where did you get the idea that dissatisfied people were in minority? Always in majority in your society.
Oh, okay. I'm just catching up with you. I certainly have no authority on the USSR. All I know is that what happened in 1989 could not have happened in 1979. I don't know why, but it couldn't have. I don't believe
that, that's true, but you said, you know, it's like a tipping point, and
well,
satisfied became the majority.
Yeah.
Is
that true? I would say that dissatisfied people are a majority everywhere. But that doesn't necessarily give them a specific goal. It doesn't tell them what to do about it. Something happened in 1988-89 that was different from what happened before. And I once felt emboldened to say that I thought that rock and roll had an important part to play in the destruction of the Soviet Union. And I was very surprised to see a Russian, he's not an authority, he's a Russian, who said the same thing a few months ago. I had it in my computer, my hard drive crashed a while ago, so I don't know who it was now. But I think that he felt the same way, that the rock and roll had given Soviet youth in particular a taste of something that they wanted and gave them some sort of direction that they hadn't had before. But I'm by no means an authority on this. Yes?
In Eric Hoffer's book, The True Believer, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
He states that the flash point for action and revolution is often not when conditions worsen to an unbearable point, but when conditions start to improve and people, for the first time, see that they could continue to improve, such as in the USSR in the 80s, if I'm correct in my history. How do you think that would apply to the seemingly worsening global conditions that we see every year? Do you think that the worsening conditions will prove to actually keep people muted and unactive? Or do you think that we will reach a breaking point with that that would contradict Popper?
I wouldn't dream of making a prediction of that kind. No one knows anything like that. No one can ever predict what's going to happen next year. Well, they try every year, of course. I'll take a last question.
I'm curious about your thoughts on the medical field and its directions. It seems to me that they're moving at breakneck speeds in some cases, in my opinion. Things like nanotechnology and genetic studies. Do you think that perhaps there's a threshold that we may have already crossed, at which there's a point of no return, or could we be reaching a threshold that we seem to take a step back and examine everything that's ever been?
A threshold toward what? Threshold to something.
Towards the point of no return.
But into what? From where to where?
Eliminating the gods. You know, taking our own actions.
Oh, well, yeah. It doesn't seem to me like a step into a new paradigm. Myself, we've been working at this for centuries, for thousands of years of being able to control everything, and we're still working at it, yeah, for sure. But whether we would reach a point of no return, that I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to comment on. I don't know. I don't have any idea. They tell me at the back of the room that it's time for me to quit. So I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good question.
If I may have your attention for a moment, thank you for coming out. There's a group of us, we're called the Puget-ish group. There are various different groups throughout all the different